I want to talk with you today about a challenging topic for effective altruists, and that is what I call upstream altruism, which is very early stage action. So, I love the name effective altruism. It's very catchy and it's powerful. It does, however, imply that altruism that doesn't fit the definition is ineffective. That means that we've set a high bar for this movement. We actually have to try to make the definition fit. If a form of altruism is effective, we have to make sure they come under our umbrella. We don't want to insult people who are doing effective altruism and make our definition not fit what they're doing. So it's a high bar. And it's an early movement, so we're still working on this. So Oliver Habrika, who is Director of Strategy for Center for Effective Altruism here in the U.S., says it this way: EA is, we are skeptical of non-quantifiable interventions, and rightfully so. And this is a good attitude to have. What we need to do, though, is look at some cases where quantifying is really tough. Sometimes it's really hard, but that's what we're here to work on. So he was sort of challenging us in this session to take this on and say, all right, you know, how can we deal with this at the early stages? We're going to look at some challenging cases, look at the question of long-term thinking, why it's essential, and one thing Oliver specifically brought up is he would love it if we could come up with causal models for what upstream efforts work and don't work. And this is super hard, okay? But I'm not here to tell you how to do this. We're here to work on it together as a team. Okay, why work at the early stage? Well, the earliest stage is where you have super high leverage, right? And we'll go through some examples. Every solution to any problem was once very early stage. The initial idea, that first step, it's not even a meme yet. Someone had an insight. Two ideas came together in a brain and created a new idea. This is the first step to any solution, any problem, right? Super early stage. You can see where I'm going with this. How are we going to tell Oliver how to quantify this? This is going to be really hard, okay? Best example, of course, is science. We all love science, you know, a lot, almost, you know, technology is based on science, medicine is based on science, we love it. But science starts with that first insight, okay? So it's not, doing things at the very early stages is not for everyone. It requires a certain type of thinking, dedication, perseverance. You have to be self-confident. And of course, to carry out altruism, you need people at all the stages. Take the mosquito net analogy, right? You've got to have the person who installs them right at the last stage, and then you work your way earlier and earlier, right? There's the person who came up with the machine to make them. There's the person who first had the idea. Well, maybe mosquitoes are the cause of this. Who was that? I don't know who that was. But without that person, none of this would happen. Now, sometime another person would have had that realization sooner or later, but when would that have been? How many years would that have been? You've got this huge delay. Potentially huge. That's the question, right? And remember, these are kind of unique people who have these mental achievements. So just because, you know, one of these mental achievements happened in this year, when would it have happened if that person hadn't had that insight? Would it have been 1 year, 10 years, decades? Sometimes it's not clear. It could be quite a while. So in EA, we have a three big selection criteria for our causes. We like to see big scale. We like to see neglectedness. Nobody's really working on this. And we like to see solvability. So looking at the early stages, scale, not too hard. It's the same kind of calculation that you would do for other stuff. The neglectedness again, and early stage, scale and neglectedness tends to do very well because these are hard problems. Solvability, that's where we're going to have trouble, or tractability. And in order to figure out solvability, we want reason, evidence, and data. And at the very early stages, there's no evidence or data. There is nothing, okay? All you have is reason. So this is when I talked about the character traits. that are needed to work at this stage, well, you'd better have really good reason. If you don't have data or evidence, you'd better do really well on the reason. Now, we work very hard at that in our movement. We work very hard to use reason as best we can, which means some of us here may be uniquely suited for this early stage work, even though it's extremely difficult. So at 80,000 hours, they have a helpful chart to look at solvability, and it's such a big chart that it's on three slides. You see the y-axis is solvability score, in other words, how solvability is this problem. And on this page, we've got 6 to 3.5. So at the top is solvability is the best. And then there are three ways to judge solvability. These are the columns. On the left, it's if pursuing direct interventions. So this is late stage altruism. On the right is if pushing for social or policy change. So this is things involving human minds, convincing people of things. And if we go down, here's the next page and the next page, all the way down to -2 solvability, right? That's really bad. But if you look at that first column, it talks about things like, let's see. Here we go. The solvability estimate can go from -2 in terms of the least solvable to 6 as the best in a very short time. And the reason for that is, if you look at this, at these, the first column and the third column are about other people's views of things. It talks about consensus, it talks about experts, it talks about relevant people. In other words, if you're in the first or the third column, you're interacting with other people, and they are helping you figure out solvability. In the middle, if you're looking for new solutions, it doesn't talk about that at all. All it talks about is what's plausible, what's uncertain, what's promising, excellent ideas, but it doesn't talk about other people at all. You could be on your own, and we're going to talk about some cases where I've seen people be on their own. They have that first insight, and I think we have people here who may be in that situation at some time. Or a very small team. That happens all the time in our community. Somebody has a big, you know, this is the cause X thing, right? How do you know if you have cause X? Okay, we're gonna try to grapple with that. Okay, so let's take an example from the history of the solvability estimate changing very rapidly. Edward Jenner and smallpox, okay? Hopefully we all know the story or remember the story about he was one of the first people who made the connection that dairy maids who got cowpox did not get smallpox. He noticed that, right? And in science, this is the first step. You notice something. Often it's something that is something that doesn't make sense according to your current theories, something bizarre. And most people who are not good scientists just brush it off. They don't notice it. It's the good scientists who say, wait a minute. Why would that be? What could that mean? So in his own mind, one person's mind, it went from -2, which is, it's impossible. We don't know we have no idea how to do this. And in his mind alone, in a very short time, it went from -2 to 6. He made a huge jump in one person's mind. It turns out he wasn't the only one who had that. There were other people thinking this, but they didn't follow through. You know, they did a couple steps and then they dropped it. So that's where persistence comes in, right? And self-confidence. Not only did he make this observation, he took the next step. He did the experiment, and then he continued and he pushed this thing forward. So this is the situation that you or someone you admire often can find him or herself in. Suddenly, a huge problem which looked impossible now looks totally solvable. That doesn't mean it's easy. It could be very difficult. It could take many decades and a huge team of people. But the solution has become very clear, but only in one mind, right? So you see why Oliver's challenge to us is so difficult. How do you come up with criteria or evidence when you're talking about an idea in one mind? Very difficult. Okay, so time horizon. You'll notice if you go back to that solvability scoring system, it deliberately favors near-term solutions, and it uses terms like soon, within a decade, not soon, at least a decade. This is reasonable. Human beings have a discount rate in our heads, and this is how we work. Things that are in the future aren't as valuable as things we can have soon or right now. And that's just normal human behavior. And there's good reasons for that, having to do with the uncertainty of the future. But if we take this attitude, I mean, if we only go by that chart exactly as it's written, are we discouraging possibly important long-term efforts, especially in science? I'm concerned, you know, innovation is important. It's absolutely critical. And our models need to, if our models don't highlight that, we might need to tweak the wording a little bit. So you've probably heard of HITS-based giving from the Open Philanthropy Project. I think this early stage work has elements in common with HITS-based giving in terms of grappling with extreme uncertainty in your decision making. So Open Philanthropy Project, we suspect that high risk, high reward philanthropy could be described as a HITS business where a small number of enormous successes account for a large share of the total impact and compensate for a large number of failed projects. So if you choose to work early stage, you have to accept that most new ideas are wrong, right? And that's okay. And that's why this community and its search for evidence and its search for refutations of our ideas, this vehement search for refutations of our ideas, is so critical. If you choose to work at early stage, you have to be the most brutal critic of yourself. And I've seen people do this, and they are successful if they take that role. And if they say, I'm not going to be angry at people who try to knock me down, they're my allies. You know, they're the ones that are going to prevent me from wasting my time on ideas that are wrong. Right? Especially the earlier stage you are, the more you know, okay, it seems like a great idea, but is it true? Especially, you know, in any field. And that certainly includes science. You always have to be looking for refutations. And you should love it. You should love that process. Because otherwise, the whole thing is too painful. Right? You can't have new ideas be knocked down all the time, which is a normal procedure, if it's going to be an unpleasant task. I know the best people I know who do this, they love to have their minds changed. They joyfully leap at being refuted. Very hard to do, but if you can get into that mode of truly putting the ideas above your ego, that's where the power is, if you want to work at this stage. And I love meeting those people, I love working for those. I'm not one of those people, but I try to facilitate them. And most of us in this room perhaps are not the most brilliant genius who will come up with a cure for smallpox. But we can find those people, and we can support them, and we can raise money for them, which is what I try to do. Okay. Something like what Open Philanthropy Project is describing here, they may come up with this causal model for what works and doesn't work that Oliver had challenged us to come up with. I don't have that model. But, and maybe one of you have some thoughts on it, I would love to hear it, and I'm sure Oliver would love to hear it. So let's do some examples. I'm going to do a few examples. I've got a couple people I've asked to speak about their examples, and then I want to open it up to you guys. So start thinking about what examples you've either heard of or maybe have participated in on really early stage stuff. So I want to give a weird example just to kind of open up your mind to how difficult and bizarre sometimes this work can be. If you think back to the early anatomy studies done in Scotland, it was illegal to do dissection, except of prisoners, and there weren't enough prisoners who were executed. So in the middle of the night, they go out and dig up bodies in the cemeteries now. So in terms of high leverage, early stage research, that's how weird things can get, right? Who was it who donated the bribe to the guard who in the cemetery, right? Talk about high leverage, early stage giving. Not recommending this for you guys. But I'll give you a couple. So that's the weirdest example I can give you, but I'll give you some more modern day examples. There was a proposed United Nations treaty quite a while back that wanted to put all the resources in space as the common heritage of mankind, which sounds great. Totally wonderful idea. However, the proposal seemed to be that the UN would be in charge of harvesting those resources and delivering them to us here on Earth and dividing them up among the billions of people here. And we know space settlement is important for environmental reasons. We don't want to have happen to our biosphere what already happened to the dinosaurs, right? And that is going to happen sooner or later. We have to spread the biosphere off the Earth. It's important for existential risk reasons. So I was very young at the time, early 20s, looked at this and said, you know, the UN is not the correct agency for doing this. They are not known for their, you know, mining ability. And in fact, it's never going to happen if the first profits have to be divided by 5 or 6 or 7 billion people. It's just never going to happen. It's going to stop this whole process. There never will be asteroid mining, which is how the profits from that is how you drive space settlement. So we got in our cars in Boston and a bunch of kids basically straight out of school and drove to DC and we lobbied against this treaty. And we're like 20 of us. It's a very similar crowd to the EA, you know, early EA prototype folks. And it wasn't passed. I think there wasn't a huge support for it and there was some opposition. We were the opposition and it didn't pass. And so now, like 35 years later, you're seeing asteroid mining companies start to form. That's early stage, right? 35 years in advance. And trying to predict, you know, will this Moon Treaty make any difference? That's an example of very early stage, but also how a tiny handful of people can make a difference if you work early stage. We'll be hearing about the Foresight Institute from someone else, so I'll go on to open source software. You may recall that it used to be called free software, and the problem with the term free software is that in English, the word free doesn't mean just free as in freedom, it also means free as in zero price. And it turns out when you would try to explain it to people, all they could hear was the zero price. And it was impossible to get them to understand the point of free software. They just couldn't get it. It couldn't happen. So a bunch of us said, you know, this is not working. And I was the one who said, well, open source, how about that? And as you know, those of you who were paying attention back then know that there was this huge uptick in interest and understanding of the software when the name came through. And it was not difficult, but it was pretty early stage and not that easy to track. I mean, the fact that it had a big uptick, why was that? Could have been some other reason, right? I'm also working with the land value tax people, and I want to work with the nonviolent communication people because they have misnamed their movements. That's why effective altruism is such an awesome name. It's a great name. It's really working for us. These people who are doing excellent work on important causes have lousy names. So an easy way to help people out early stage is to help them rename their, you know, if you see something that's not working for them, say, you know, you really need to just totally rename this thing. It's not working for you. And I think they will both benefit a lot when they do that. We're going to do your examples, but first I'm going to do two examples from a couple of my favorite nonprofits. One of them I advise, I don't need to introduce to you the Machine Intelligence Research Institute because they have been very prominent here at this conference. So they're not cause X. They're already on the list. They're already actively being considered. But we have Julie Bossman here. Come on up, Julia. She's president of Foresight Institute, and she's going to give us about 2 minutes about why Foresight Institute may be cause X.
Hi, so Foresight Institute, we want to accelerate the technologies that can have a massive benefit for the world. And we look especially at those technologies that are getting not as much attention or not as much funding as they need. We've seen lots of discussions about technologies and about AI. AI is getting a lot of attention, but there are things that we think will have a massive benefit for the world that are not. So one that we had recently, for example, was a summit on energy and breakthrough technologies. And we had some amazing projects and proposals for low energy desalination, artificial photosynthesis, and we're now working on getting these scientists who are working on these things together with funders, with organizations that support them. We bring out white papers and we bring out the reports to support these causes. We're also active with AI, so the next workshop we're doing is artificial intelligence for scientific progress. So it's bringing together that We believe that scientific progress and technological progress is one of the highest levers how we can make a difference in the world. I gave you the desalination example just now. And when we think about that, we analysts have predicted that many wars in the next decades may be started because of a scarcity of resources, and that scarcity could be water, it could be food that is affected in areas affected by climate change. And if we have technology that all of a sudden makes this abundant or makes it radically cheaper to have clean water, it's not just a good thing to have in the world, but we could actually prevent wars with that. Artificial intelligence for scientific progress is where we are bringing together people with backgrounds in machine learning and deep learning, data science, and connect them to people who are working on very tough problems in material sciences, physical sciences, and life sciences, especially on the atomic precision level, and see how these two brilliant fields can come together and make a progress. So, and this brings me to the last point. What Foresight does is we look at what is out there, what are the fields that could have a massive benefit for the world, and which people aren't talking to each other that should be talking to each other. So once we've identified an application field, we look at our curator network and we find the very brilliant high leverage people and bring them all together in one room and then sprinkle some magic dust on it to make it happen. So that's what we do at the events besides our advocacy. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. So Foresight is the nanotechnology organization, also AI. Our next group I'd like to highlight is the Sea Study Institute, and we have Joe Quirk here to tell us about that. And why is Sea Study Institute CauseX, Joe?
Thanks, Christine, and I love what Julie is doing. Sea Study is building floating nations on the sea. And I encourage effective altruists to think about the source code from which rules emerge. So all these things that people care about, that I care about too, animal welfare, poverty, you know, climate problems, these are all subsets of a deeper, more fundamental problem with governance itself. And if you think about 193 nation states around the world, those obviously don't represent the range of ideas that 7 billion people have produced. And if you think about Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, they didn't change Hewlett-Packard from within. They proposed their personal computer. Hewlett-Packard told them it was crazy. They left and went and founded Apple. So if you accept that the source of solutions is startups, and you bring a Silicon Valley sensibility to the problem of poor governance, you want to create startup governance. And unfortunately, all the land in the world is claimed by all these old, lumbering, gigantic dinosaur nation states that are violent and only been around a short period of time. And many of the innovations that could change humanity are being held back by 20th century rules. So fortunately, nearly half the world's surface is completely unclaimed by existing governments. This is the blue frontier. It's entirely aquatic. And the technology for floating cities is at hand, or very soon to be at hand. If you think about oil platforms, they're at sea a long period of time. Oil platform workers typically live half their lives, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, on oil platforms. If you think about cruise ships are essentially self-governing. There are hundreds of them on the sea right now. If you get on a cruise ship, you'll often notice that it's cheaper the first night on the cruise ship than it was in a coastal hotel. It's flying the flag of Liberia. Liberia is a third world basket case. How is it enforcing laws? The cruise ship is essentially self-governing. It's like a Disneyland at sea. And there are, in fact, four Disney ships at sea. The technology to combine the cruise ship with the oil platform is going to be put in operation this year. Shell's Prelude will be floating in international waters for up to 25 years. It's larger than the Empire State Building. As construction costs get cheaper, greener, and 3D printed, this is all going to rapidly get cheaper. So the goal of the Seasteading Institute is to cause the proliferation of as many of these startup nano nations as possible so we can discover superior ways to live together. It's not just a long-term dream, it's a short-term dream. The project I'm working on right now is our floating city project, using existing Dutch technology. If you go to Rotterdam, you will find a floating pavilion, floating on a platform that's capable of lasting for a century in seawater. So the technology for floating cities already exists in shallow waters. Shallow waters are controlled by existing nations. Many of these nations permit special economic zones, sort of legal islands within their countries where they experiment with lower taxes, faster administration, fewer regulations. At least 4,000 of these have proliferated across the world, almost done. So we're trying to build a floating one just off sea. Check out our floating city project at the Seasteading Institute and learn how you can participate in creating startup governments, the platforms from which you guys can create an altruistic world. Thanks for listening.
Say again your name, please.
That's Joe Quirk, and it's Seasteading Institute. We're wrapping it up. Okay, I'm going to give you a fun thing, which is I want to give you an example of another area where data collection doesn't work too well, which is hit-and-run altruism, I call it, where the project is so small and quick that taking data just doesn't make sense. It's infeasible. We do it, this is micro-altruism, we do it for fun, we all do it all the time with each other, especially at a conference like this, where we're trying to help each other, and I'm going to do two 30-second hit-and-run altruisms with you right now, because making you more effective in your lives, because I know you're at an EA conference, I know will pay off for all of us, right? So first I'm going to mention, we did a Less Wrong meetup on sleep, and we found out most of the people there were in their 20s, and they were almost all having sleep issues of some kind, and I want to tell you folks, this is not normal. It's not appropriate for people in their 20s and 30s to be having serious sleep issues. You are aging prematurely. This is the opposite of longevity and life extension that we want. And it could be that you'll live shorter than your parents because of this. And I'm not going to get into why this is. I'm going to tell you how to fix it, which is, you see this ring on my finger? This is a sleep tracking device, okay? It's the best sleep tracking device you can buy today. I think it's the best sleep tracking device that's sold commercially ever. And it's called Oura. It's out of Finland. This will help you figure out what's going on exactly with your sleep. It shows deep sleep, REM sleep, the whole deal. And it's been wonderful. So, highly recommend if your sleep isn't right, and my guess is your sleep isn't right. If you're here, probably it isn't right, okay? So, if you can afford it, get one of these rings and try to work on it, and I think it's worth the money. The last is, a lot of you are in your 20s and 30s. This is a time of romantic churning, which can be very distracting from your effective altruism. And so I give a lot of talks on how to deal with that and how to nail this issue so that you have your romantic situation under control and working well for you. So I wrote a little ebook. I wrote it for women, but all the men in this room were perfectly smart enough to translate, okay, if she's doing this, I have to do that, got it. And I'm happy to send it to anybody here, and just for free, because y'all are effective altruists. And I'll put up my email address, there you go. Just email to me and say, send the book. I will send you that book, and you will have romantic love. So, you can also connect with me on Facebook. I'd love to be your Facebook friend, but send me a PM, private message also, because otherwise I ignore those, because you all know they're all full of fake these days. And my main affiliation is Foresight Institute, which you heard about from Julia, the nanotechnology organization, bringing digital control to the structure of matter. So, that's my message. We're out of time. I'm going to go over to Poly West, where there's a big sign that says speaker. I will hang out there, and if any of you come, you can talk about sleep or romantic love, but of course, you know, we're really here to talk about existential risk and effective altruism. So, thank you very much.
Great, thanks so much.